Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. If this is the first time you're tuning in with us, thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to go to our website, focuscompounding.com, to get access to investor write-ups from Jeff, going all the way back to 2005. The best place to go to get everything that we push out into the investing universe is to follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Focused Compound. All the information is in the description below. So in today's podcast, Jeff, we're going to talk about an email that somebody had sent in to us. And I think it's a great topic that gets brought up often. So we're going to, you know, I figure instead of just, maybe you turning into a blog post or responding, we had thought that it would be good to bring up in podcast form, since it is one of those more frequent questions that we get. And the email says, the person says, I was wondering if you could discuss on the show or in a blog post how you think about the possibility of margins reverting to more historical levels. He said, here I am thinking specifically of something like Monarch Cement, which is a company that we've actually talked about over the years on the podcast. The company trades at a substantial discount to its private market value, i.e. an acquirer would likely pay 10 to 12 times EBITDA, and the shares currently trade at less than 7 times EBITDA when excluding cash and investments. However, this is based on 2023 financials, where the gross margin was a record 54%. A reversion to more average levels would be 30 to 33% since 2006, would erode most of the margin of safety. This is obviously a scale business where the company is benefiting from higher volumes, but there's a number of other companies that also have had record margins on the back of price increases in recent years. How do you think about this? And it's a great topic, especially for us as microcap, smaller cap investors, because if a company is growing over time, they are going to benefit from scale more. So it's more so, how do you think about a normalized margin? Is there a new margin? Do you use the past as a guide? How do you typically think about that? Monarch Cement, US Lime, these are companies that have grown over time, have benefited from price increases and probably their scale. So just wanted to talk about that on the podcast, how you think about that, how you think about reversion to the mean when it comes to margins, and just how you think about that when you're valuing different companies, because it does come up often in microcaps and small caps as the business starts to grow more and benefit from its cost structure, hopefully.
So you can break down the costs and the price. So, you know, there was a book, I think it was a Better, Simpler Strategy, something like that, but it broke down the basic idea of how companies work in terms of making money, which is that you have a difference between the willingness to pay and the willingness to sell. Willingness to sell being willingness to supply, you know, being what your suppliers and your employees want, and willingness to pay being what you're able to charge your customer. Now, that's not necessarily that related to price or cost, because there could be a lot of willingness and yet someone's not exploiting it. So See's Candies, Buffett raised the price for a long time such that the real price per pound went up over time. So there was a higher willingness to pay than there was a price that way. You have to remember, trying to break things down, things like US Lime and most certainly Monarch Cement, it's, even if they're operating at one site, it's unlikely that there's huge volume gains in terms of physical volumes done. It does vary a bit cyclically, but you're having a lot of variation in terms of price. And then also you're going to have a difference that's complicated for people, which has to do with reported margins under GAAP, cash margins, and margins going forward, which has a time lag. So that's an issue with people not understanding inflation necessarily that well. If you have a period of inflation, then you have rising and sometimes falling prices of other things. When that happens, whether you are accounting for the way in which you're accounting for that LIFO, FIFO, et cetera, is really important, because you're capturing a lot of the inflation in it. And that will reverse when the inflation reverses or when the deflation reverses. Some companies might benefit in some ways from their category deflating a bit. Others benefit from inflating. A lot appear to benefit on a GAAP basis, but don't benefit on a going forward cash basis. So it makes their profits more illusory. They're not really there, you know.
Mm-hmm. So is one spot or tell to think about the actual increase in volume, or if there hasn't been an increase in volume, because prices, especially in cyclicals or more commodity driven businesses, over time price, you know, could cure itself, right? That saying, high prices cure high prices. Would that make you feel less confident about that new high margin being a normalized figure if there is no sort of volume growth with that?
Not necessarily. I look at it as like the Porter forces that he talks about, right? So a way to think about this is it's an issue of bargaining between different parties. You can end up paying your suppliers more. You could end up paying your customers less, you know. You could, how does your margin go down? You could end up paying your employees more, and you could, so what are the inputs for things? So for something like cement or something, let's say, something that's doing that, their input could be labor, unionized or not, the commodities that they're buying, because they may not have a supply of it themselves. They may have to buy it from someone else. Sometimes they may have a secure supply themselves. And then also something like natural gas or something as an input. It may not be natural gas, but something like that. And so then it would just be a question of what the cost of those things are. In other cases, you know, take U.S. lime, for instance, some of their inputs are secure to an extent because, for instance, they don't have to go out and buy more of their reserves. It could cost them more to take it out and process it and everything, as you can see with like, so like there's probably costs associated with higher diesel costs or something with actually turning reserves into something that you can use, because there is some level of mining basically going on. But, you know, that's different than having to buy it in the market from someone else that way, as you might have to for some companies buying as an input oil or natural gas or something that's benchmark off those prices pretty close. So it depends, but sometimes you see a fall in an input cost and not a fall in the finished product coming out. A lot of this also has to do with the elasticity of demand, having to do with price stuff. So how much does a change in price affect the performance of the volume that you have, right? So in some industries, it's very sensitive to it. In other ones, it's not. In some industries, there's things going on with complements or substitutes. You know, this is basic microeconomic stuff that are the first things they talk about in class like that. But basically, something like lime, for instance, although diversified across a bunch of different industries, there isn't a lot of connection between the need for lime and what's going on in those industries with complements like and there are not substitutes that are, you know, making a lot of sense in terms of price, so that there's very, very little sensitivity to price, especially because you have often one supplier and it's often not a huge part of your total cost, you know. Ways people can think about that is like other industries might break this down more. I think you've mentioned like uranium or something. So if someone talks about uranium, they will break down how much is the cost of uranium as a part of the price of electricity produced by a nuclear power plant. How much is the actual price of uranium versus associated costs with it, which are not things that are the price, but are things that have to do with getting it, processing it safely, doing all sorts of things with it that add up to a bunch of other things. In some cases, the price is not necessarily that important a part of it. And then you have accounting things too with some companies, how they account for freight costs. So if the prices that you're seeing are not reflective of cost to the customer, but are costs that are reflective of it at the factory gate, they would call it. So prices that it is as it's being put on freight, but really the customer is often buying the freight too, but you're subtracting that out of it, versus cases in which that's included. And that also would throw off the margin because it throws off both the numerator and the denominator.
Mm-hmm. What if the entire industry has had margins increase, though? I mean, that's kind of his main question. This is obviously a scale business where the company's benefiting from higher volumes, but there's a number of other companies that have also had record margins on the back of price increases in recent years. How do you think about this?
If companies want lime, they want cement, some of these things that we're talking about, there are other categories that fall in the same thing. they often only have one supplier and they have to pay the price that the supplier wants. There's no reason why a supplier would cut price to stimulate demand. A main reason why, that's a very, very big part of it. So as opposed to, say, another cycle. So the cycle here in cement or something, and certainly lime, would be different than in, say, what NVIDIA does. Because what happens is the difference is that although at a top of a cycle you might make it even more in something like NVIDIA, the gross margins might be even higher. At a bottom, there should be an incentive, because of the way that inventories work, for someone to try to clear inventories by cutting prices. There's no reason that I could ever see as to why a company that's supplying, like say US Lime or something, it would not make sense that they would think that cutting their prices would help clear out physical volume that they have. The classic example of this is perishable things, which can be metaphorically kind of perishable, like an airline seat or a hotel room, because it's at the end of this night, it's gone. Or perishable, like perishable things sold in grocery stores and stuff, or it can be perishable like a fashion good. All of those literally have an incentive to cut their prices to clear things out. And actually some of them, with physical goods, have an incentive to cut to do it even if it doesn't generate a profit for them, because they need to bring in new stuff to do it. So there's actually an incentive just to get rid of it. You sell to close out or liquidating something even if you can't get any profit from it. I don't see why there'd be any incentive to do that with these sorts of things at all. So
because its lifespan is infinite, basically.
No, because it won't stimulate any demand. So here's the thing. If you tell it's used for a bunch of different things. So like say lime. Lime could be used in things that have to do with water, things that have to do with steel, chemicals, things that have to do with construction, depending on where you are. There's lots of limestone stuff that could be used in construction things. And then you have things, obviously, that we talked about with cement as going into that stuff, right? So that's just some of them, but that covers a lot of those categories. There's no reason in a bunch of their things. You might have a municipal thing buying from you for 15 years in a row. If you tell them it's half off, they won't buy anymore. If you tell them it's twice as much, depending on if there's someone else close enough in terms of freight things, they might look for an alternate supplier and they might get mad at you. If you slowly double it, they probably won't notice. But certainly you can't stimulate demand by cutting price. You can't stimulate demand by cutting price in certain other industries too, because it messes some things up, holding the inventory for the customer as opposed to other things. So, you know, it's hard to stimulate demand for, I talked about like copper wire, right, with Encore wire, but also corks in the wine industry. It's hard to stimulate demand in those things because no one wants to hold more inventory at your customer than they already have in terms of messing up their operations, right? So no one wants additional supply to a construction site ahead of time or something, or in greater number than they would. They're not going to do more construction just because you cut the price on this item when 95% of the cost is not this item. You know, things like that. But you can clearly stimulate demand for other things. Maybe the easiest way to think about it is like a supermarket, right? So what can a price cut do? Okay. So, and why does the price of some things fall? So a classic example of what they can stimulate demand for you is they can cut the price of pork. Pork would be a really good example. So they can get you to switch from chicken or beef. It's unlikely that you'll increase overall your meat consumption totally, but if they need to clear out stuff, which they would because of animal things, there's a whole cycle to it, and so you'll just have too many chickens, too many pigs, too many cattle at some times and not enough at other times. They can clear it out by cutting the price, and then that causes that for you to buy it. At other times, there's issues where they can't, right? Sometimes you produce a product as a byproduct. So chicken in the United States, there's high demand for boneless, skinless chicken breast, white meat. There's not high demand for dark meat. This causes that when there's a boom in chicken in the United States in terms of consumption, you inadvertently cause additional dark meat, which may have to be sold in other countries and stuff. They can't stimulate enough demand for dark meat usually in the United States. So there are things like that, and then there are other things where cutting the price has a big effect. But there are entire categories where it doesn't. Like, you know, take movies. Movies are the same price for all of the movies. There's a reason for that, because if you have, you know, you have Madam Web and you have Dune, if you cut the price of Madam Web in half and double the price of Dune, you may have fewer people go to Dune because they're trying to save money. It won't actually cause people to switch to going to Madame Web because they don't want to go to it because of how much time it takes, that they don't think they're going to enjoy themselves, etc. It has nothing to do with the price. That's, to them, is not the biggest cost. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these things, the freight cost is the biggest cost. Some of the other things we talk about, switching costs are big costs. But a lot of times the price part of it is a small part of your overall cost consideration. If it's a big part of your cost consideration, then you'll switch, you know? Also, at the supermarket, they can get you to increase frequency, but that just pulls demand forward, and then you end up not buying more later with that for most things, not everything. But it's the easiest thing is to get you to stock up on something now at the expense of a competitor. That's fine. Getting you to actually frequently consume more is harder, you know? So couponing and things might get you to buy a lot more toothpaste, but mostly it'll just get you to use it, buy it now and use it over time. It's hard for them to actually get you to use more than, you know, they have to convince you to do that. And switching is very hard by a price change.
Mm-hmm.
So I just would say, look at what would actually affect the differences in price between things. If you're saying consumer discretionary, could you have margins come down on, you know, things sold at Best Buy and Home Depot and stuff? Sure. If you're saying lime and cement, I think it's more likely that more money would go to workers and more money would go to input costs than it is that the cost would come down. I don't think you should necessarily assume that the cost will come down a lot.
So in a situation like Monarch Cement, then, trading at less than 7x EBITDA, this individual thinks that a private party would pay 10 to 12 times EBITDA. It is record margins. How would you be thinking about it then? Would you think that's a cheap price? Do you think you're at a higher end price because where we're at in the cycle? How would you be thinking about this if you were looking at Monarch Cement with a fresh set of eyes, trying to value it and, you know, think what it could be worth and where your return could come from?
I probably wouldn't want to buy it when it's at all-time highs in terms of margins and stuff. I'd have to look, like I said, into the cost structure and everything. In terms of the argument that it's cheaper than other people would pay, yeah, it's still a very reasonable price versus publicly traded comparable companies, and it's cheap versus buying something. And you would definitely buy it instead of replacing it with something else. So I agree with all of that. Yeah. And I don't see why the price would come down through bargaining power of other people, but I could see why lots of other costs in the economy could go up, sure.
And this situation is a little bit different too, right? This is more of a overlooked stock. I believe it's a family that are huge shareholders, right? Isn't it like a founder-led family that owns this company or the majority
sort
of it?
Sort of. I think there's maybe technically five families or so that may still own shares in some form. But yeah, the person running and stuff is a descendant of family members who've run it before, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they also have a stock portfolio. Correct.
Yes, they it's overcapitalized and stuff. Yeah. I mean, on a replacement cost basis, it's cheap. Yeah, there's no denying that. And you can see how very expensive some things in the rest of the world that are diversified things in this category are. Yeah. But if you're asking me, is it better to buy now with high margin stuff than before? No, I kind of disagree on that. I would rather buy it when it has lower margins, knowing that it could have high margins, than vice versa. It's my same thinking on like the interest rate things and stuff. I don't think it's time to get excited about high margins now. And I think that it's the same thing, like I said, with the interest rate things. You know, I think the time to worry about what high interest rates would do to banks and stuff was when they were near zero, not when they're at 5. I don't think it makes sense to look in the rearview mirror and worry a lot more about something that you probably weren't worried about before. Here, I don't know that a lot of people were expecting much higher margins and stuff in the future for them, for this company, for A-Mark Precious Metals, for steel companies, for whatever, you know. Yeah. You can look at the long-term median stuff. That's why we have them. I think that long-term median margins and stuff are more helpful in figuring out what it'll be. There's a component, like I said, in terms of gap things, in terms of having higher inflation would cause things to happen to margins and stuff. Because you're capturing a time element in that, that's important to understand. It depends on how the slower something turns, the more it'll look like the margin is higher because of inflation over time generally. Although sometimes there'll be deflation in certain categories. But as a rule, the longer you hold things, the more those things will look better in a higher inflation world. So something that, you know, a grocery store will have less benefit from margin stuff for inflation things. Not that it won't have it, it won't look better, but you'll be less likely to confuse the margin issue than, say, a jewelry store or something that might have very slow turns. And if there's constant inflation, then you might be capturing more of that inflation than you think. But this will show up in the cash numbers because you'll see that their conversion into cash will be poorer and poorer over time if that happens.
Got it. Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focus Compounding Podcast. Email me your questions to have them potentially on the podcast, or we could turn it into podcast or topic for a blog post at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. I'll thank everybody so much for tuning in with Jeff and I. If you're interested in learning about our money management services, you can reach out to me at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. Be sure to hit the subscribe button wherever you are listening or watching us here today, and we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.